Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
It's not the last grain that emptied the hourglass. When a lumberjack is cutting down a tree, it's not just the last strike of the axe that cuts down the tree. It's all of them accumulated. And it might be that the last swipe of the axe that the lumberjack uses is not the strongest one that he used. It might have been one of the weaker chops that he gave to the tree. But yet, it was enough because of the accumulated blows before it to knock down the tree.
Is it one isolated sin that leads to our destructive behavior? As Pastor David shares in his message, it's often a string of sinful behaviors that leads to destruction. Satan is sneaky in the way that he can lead us into one behavior that escalates over time. This was demonstrated in 2 Kings in the lives of the Israelites. Their persistent act of idolatry led to the defeat and displacement of the Israelites at this time. It goes further to say that they tried to hide their actions from God and chose to fear other gods of insignificance. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
Tonight, we hope to get through 2 Kings chapter 17 and 18 together. It's a big chunk of scripture for us to work our way through, but the two chapters really go together rather nicely. Because as a shadow hanging over both of these chapters is the mighty Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire is going to conquer the northern kingdom of Israel in chapter 17, and it's going to gravely threaten the southern kingdom of Judah in chapter 18. So let's begin here, taking a look here, 2 Kings chapter 17, starting at verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Now, Hoshea, the son of Elah, we were introduced to him back in 2 Kings chapter 15. He was a man who successfully led a conspiracy against Pekah, the king of Israel. And after the successful assassination, he took the throne and started his own brief dynasty. And I'm fascinated by the description here of Hoshea in verses 1 and 2, where it says that he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Now, isn't that interesting? He was bad, but not quite as bad as some of his predecessors. He was an evil man, but by no means the worst of the kings of Israel. Now, sadly, his bloody overthrow of the preceding king and his violent ascent to power did not make him unusually evil. You would think that a man who murdered his predecessor to take the throne, he would be the champion of evil among the kings of Israel. But he wasn't, because the other ones were so bad in comparison. Now, I need to give you a little bit of preview of what's going to happen in the rest of the chapter. We are very close to the utter collapse of Israel and their destruction as an independent kingdom. And I want to remind you that this judgment really begins to take place in the days of Hoshea, and he was not one of the worst kings of Israel. And this reminds us of a very important principle about the judgment of God. It reminds us that the particular moment of judgment may not come at the height of sin. When God judges a nation or a culture, he has the big picture in view. And for that reason, the actual events of judgment may come at a time when things are not as bad in a relative sense. I mean, wouldn't you take a look at this from a human perspective and say, well, look, Hosea's not as bad. Things are getting better. Maybe the next king will be better than him. And maybe we're on our way progressing to maybe eventually someday having a good king over the northern kingdom of Israel. But even though he wasn't as bad as his predecessors, God, in bringing his judgment, actually has the big picture in view. You know, when an hourglass is draining the grains of sand, it's not the last grain that emptied the hourglass. When a lumberjack is cutting down a tree, it's not just the last strike of the axe that cuts down the tree. It's all of them accumulated. And it might be that the last swipe of the axe that the lumberjack uses is not the strongest one that he used. It might have been one of the weaker chops that he gave to the tree. But yet, it was enough because of the accumulated blows before it to knock down the tree. This was the case of Hosea. By himself, he was not quite as evil as the preceding kings of Israel, but taken together, it was enough to bring God's judgment. Verse 3, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hosea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hosea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. So in the pattern of some of the kings before him, Hosea accepted the status of being a vassal kingdom or a servant kingdom to the empire of the Assyrians. And plainly put, if he paid his money and did what the king of Assyria pleased, then he would be allowed to continue on the throne of Israel. But if he didn't pay his money, or if he rebelled against the king of Assyria in any way, he should expect that the king of Assyria would come with great fury against him. This was probably in Hosea's mind after seeing an opportunity when the king came to the Assyrian throne. You see, this king that's mentioned here in verse 3, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, he came during the reign of Hosea and was probably a new king when Hosea decided to change his strategy and put his allegiance in with Egypt instead of the Assyrians. He probably thought this is a smart political move, but it was not a smart political move because, as it says there, the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hosea. He hoped to find help among the Egyptians. By the way, the Egyptians were in a constant power struggle between themselves and the Assyrian Empire. And if you just think for a moment about the geopolitical situation here, you got the mighty Assyrian Empire, you have the substantial Egyptian Empire, and geographically, who's right in the middle between these two empires? It's the land of Israel itself. Well, they were literally caught in the middle of this power struggle between these two mighty empires. And on account of this conspiracy and the failure to pay the yearly tribute money, Hosea was imprisoned by the king of Assyria. And by the way, as we might expect among the kings of Israel, Hosea did not look to the Lord for help. He looked to Egypt. Therefore, the prophet Hosea said of him, "As for Samaria, her king is cut off like a twig on the water." That's what he was like. You ever seen a little twig float down a river like the Zeeg right out here? You know, you put a little branch on it and woo, it's just carried away. There's no stability, no strength. It just goes wild with the water. That was exactly like the king of Samaria in this reference. So now, verse 5. "Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hosea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and then the cities of the Medes." End of story. Goodbye, northern kingdom of Israel. It's gone. For weeks and weeks and chapters, we've been explaining to you over and over again how after the time of Solomon, there was a civil war, and the southern 2 tribes became the kingdom of Judah, and the northern 10 tribes became the kingdom of Israel, and on and on. You know, we don't have to talk about that anymore. The kingdom of Israel is gone, conquered by the Assyrians, taken away into exile. Now, it happened after a long, dedicated campaign by the Assyrians. They besieged Samaria, the capital city of the northern kingdom, for 3 years. And even though it took a 3-year siege, it was worth it to the Assyrians. They crushed this nation, and they took this common ground, this battleground that lay between them and the Egyptians. And it says there that he took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria. When Samaria finally fell and the northern kingdom was conquered, the Assyrians implemented their customary policy towards conquered nations. They deported everyone out of the nation. They made a forced exile, and they took everybody except the very lowest classes of people. They took them back to the key cities of their empire, either to train and to utilize the talented or to enslave the able. So here we are, 200 years and 19 kings after the time of Solomon, who was the last king over a united Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel fell. Now, it was not because The God of Israel was unable to help them, but it was because they had so forsaken that God and so ignored his guidance and correction that he finally stopped actively protecting them and he let them rot and degrade according to their desire. Let me tell you something. You could argue very persuasively that God actually sent the Assyrian army to be the instrument of his judgment against the northern kingdom of Israel, but I'm just telling you tonight, you don't have to argue that. You could say that all God did with the northern kingdom of Israel was leave them alone. You want to do it on your own? Fine. God says, I'll let you do it on your own. You won't have my hand of protection. You won't have my special guidance. You won't have my counsels and my angels watching out over you. You're on your own. Enjoy it. And they were carried away. It says they were carried away to Assyria. And when the Assyrians did this, they followed their typical custom. When the Assyrians depopulated and exiled a conquered community, they led their captives away on journeys of hundreds of miles. And you know how they usually did this? They stripped them naked and they attached them together with a system of strings and fish hooks in the lip. And they led them on these long strings over forced marches of hundreds of miles to completely humiliate and degrade these conquered peoples. You know, this is a principle of the judgment of God, is that when it does finally come, it's often humiliating and degrading. And can you imagine these thousands upon thousands of former citizens of the kingdom of Israel stripped naked, fish hooks literally put through their lips and strings running them together and marched hundreds of miles away, so far away that they didn't have to have even have the thought of an easy escape to get back to their homeland. Well, that's the end of the story. But spiritually speaking, it's not the end of the story. This story aches for an explanation. It's as if at the end of verse 6, we're left crying out, why? I mean, aren't these the children of Abraham? Aren't these the descendants of the tribes? Isn't this the kingdom or the land which at one time David and Solomon ruled? What has happened to the people of God? And now the divine historian, starting at verse 7, is going to give you an extended explanation that basically lasts through the end of the chapter, explaining to you why this tremendous calamity came upon the northern kingdom of Israel. Verse 7, for it was so that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods. You see, now, as the divine historian begins to explain the fundamental reasons why the northern kingdom was conquered and taken captive, he's going to explain it, and at the root cause, it's sin. Do you see right there in verse 7? For it was so that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God. Now, I know I tried to explain to you a little bit ago the geopolitical situation. You know, it's kind of a fancy word to use, and the empire of Assyria and the empire of Egypt and this clash of civilizations and all these different things. You could talk about those things from one sense, a secular historical perspective, but let's not forget the real reason why they were taken captive. They sinned. The problem was sin. It wasn't geopolitical changes or social causes. It was sin. And specifically, the first sin listed there in verse 7 was that they feared other gods. Aren't you interested that here in verse 7, when he's talking about the sin and the idolatry of the northern kingdom of Israel, the first thing that he brings up is the Exodus deliverance. Do you realize that at the time that he spoke this, the deliverance from Egypt had happened, let me quickly give you the figure, it had happened some 600 years before this time. That's really going back into the well of history, right? It's like talking about something from the days of Martin Luther as if it was today. But that's how real it was to God and to his people, the deliverance that they had received from Egypt, that they were to remember that this was the God who had delivered them. You see, God had brought Israel up out of the land of Egypt, and remembering that act alone should have prompted Israel to a single-hearted commitment to the Lord. Yet they did not remember this, and they feared other gods and broke the covenant that God made with his people. Now, continuing on here now in verse 8, he's not done explaining. He's going to spend the rest of the chapter doing it, and it's a long chapter. It says, and they had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel, which they had made. You see, before Israel occupied Canaan in the days of Joshua, the promised land was populated by degenerate pagan peoples who practiced the worst kinds of idolatry and human sacrifice. One of the fundamental sins of the people of Israel was that they followed these ancient Canaanite ways. God wanted them to reject those ways and to worship Him, but instead they followed these gods of the degenerate peoples whom they conquered. Now I want you to notice what it says there in verse 8. Didn't that catch your eye when it said, the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel? You see, God cast out the Canaanite nations in the days of Joshua because of these sins. Now, because Israel insisted on continuing on in those sins, God says, you know what? I'm going to cast you out too. It's not that I hated the Canaanite peoples because they were Canaanites. It wasn't a racial thing. It was because they persisted in these degenerate, horrible sins over a long period of time. If you're going to share the conduct of the Canaanite tribes, then you're also going to share their same judgment. Going on now to verse 9. Also, the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their God things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. And they burned incense on all the high places, like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. And they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. For they served idols of which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this thing. You see, it says that the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord God things that were not right. Rebellion and sin tend to cloud the judgment of men. And clearly the judgment of Israel was affected. Their judgment was so impaired so as to think that they could sin secretly against the God who sees everything. You know, that's how it is. You take a man who gets so drunk that he climbs into his car and he drives and he thinks, oh, it's okay. I'm going to drive extra special careful so the police will never know that I'm drunk. And so he's going down the road at such a slow speed and in such an obviously strange way that of course the police are going to pull him over. Oh, but he thinks he's pulling a fast one. In his mind, he's got it all figured out, but his judgment is so impaired, it's so clouded that he doesn't realize how obvious his sin is. Isn't it the same way with the deceptive spell that sin can weave over us? We think we can keep it secret from God. Well, God doesn't see this. I can hide it from him. Nobody else sees it, so God must not see it either. And yet we don't realize just how mistaken and how clouded our judgment is. But they went on and committed these sins. They built for themselves high places in all their cities, just like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. You see, this is the familiar theme. The divine historian hammers away at this idea again and again. The same sins that brought judgment on the Canaanites also brought judgment on the northern kingdom of Israel. Now on to verse 13. Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant which he had made with their fathers and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. You see, in his love, God sent prophets to the northern kingdom and to the southern kingdoms. Their message was a warning against the sins that corrupted God's people and separated them from God. They invited God's people with the theme, turn from your evil ways. But as our verses tell us, nevertheless, they would not hear. God sent the messengers to help Israel and to spare them the judgment that was certain to come if they continued in their evil ways. Yet God's people became more stubborn. And when the messengers came and they rejected the messengers, their guilt was only increased. Make no mistake about it. This was a severe judgment that came upon the northern kingdom of Israel, but it only came after God had warned them and warned them and warned them, and they had repeatedly rejected these warnings, even using that phrase that you saw there that's so striking, they stiffened their necks. You know where they get that metaphor from? From the practice of oxen. A stubborn ox will make their neck hard or stiff and not bow to the yoke that is put upon them. And what does the farmer have to do when the ox stiffens his neck? Well, they use something called a goad, a sharp, sharp stick that they use to jab the flanks of the oxen. And the oxen doesn't like that and eventually has to submit to the will of the farmer. But the stiffer it makes its neck, the worse it makes it for itself. It says they followed idols and became idolaters. I like how the NIV translates this. The NIV says this, they followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. Or as the New American Standard puts it, they followed vanity and became vain. Isn't that the result of it? You follow idols and you become like them, empty, worthless, and vain. Well, again, it's repetitive here in the analysis of why the judgment came upon the northern kingdom of Israel. But I want you to see, as we pause here right before verse 16, that this is just God emphasizing the point to us. I want you to understand why this terrible calamity came upon the northern kingdom. So back now to it. Verse 16. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves a molded image and two calves, and made a wooden image, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire, practiced witchcraft and soothsaying, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel, and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. And Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel which they made. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. He tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. Well, again, it's sort of giving you the bird's eye view of all the idolatry in Israel. From the first king of the separate northern kingdom of Israel, Jeroboam the first, recorded all the way back in 1 Kings chapter 12, who initiated the state-sponsored idolatry, which ran continuously for some 200 years until, under the weight of this terrible sin, the judgment of God came upon them. As it says here, therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. This was the end of the 10 northern tribes as an independent kingdom. When they were dispersed by the Assyrians, some of them assimilated into other cultures, but others kept their Jewish identity as exiles in other lands. Now, this is something that we have to deal with here, and I hope you'll pay attention, because from time to time, you'll hear people teach about this idea of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Have you ever heard that phrase before? The 10 lost tribes. Matter of fact, there's a whole sophisticated, and I would say absolutely false doctrine called British Israelitism.
Well, that concludes the teaching portion of today's broadcast of Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara. Join us next time as Pastor David continues teaching verse by verse through the books of 1 and 2 Kings. Again, you've been listening to Enduring Word, the teaching ministry of Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. You can learn a great deal about Enduring Word by visiting our website. The web address is enduringword.com. That's enduringword.com. You can listen to the rest of Pastor David's messages from the books of 1 and 2 Kings, as well as many other messages taught from God's Word, all right from the main menu. Simply click on Media at EnduringWord.com. The best place to obtain Pastor David's teaching is through the Enduring Word podcast. Log on to EnduringWord.com and click on the Media option and then Podcast. Once you subscribe, you'll always receive the latest messages from Pastor David. Again, the website for all this information is EnduringWord.com. So log on to EnduringWord.com and continue studying with Pastor David today. If you'd like to talk with someone here at the church, call us at 805-730-1400. That's 805-730-1400. Once again, you've been listening to Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California, a listener-supported program. Please tune in next time as Pastor David continues teaching verse by verse through the books of 1 and 2 Kings. That's next time on Enduring Word.